Partisan Politics and the Road to Plutocracy. I'm Blair Fix. He who has more than enough and yet hungers for still more will find no remedy in gold or silver, for his ailment is not poverty, but insatiability and avarice. Plutarch on Love of Wealth. As billionaires dance in the halls of the second Trump administration, it's haunting how well Plutarch's 2,000-year-old words describe the state of American politics. It's a barren landscape of plutocratic insatiability. How did it get this way? One way to tell the story is to look at the battle between the ruling class and everyone else, a battle which elites are obviously winning. But another way to understand the struggle is to look at the war between factions of the ruling class, a battle that plays out largely within partisan politics. On this partisan front, the historical backdrop is that for 40 years, Republicans have been playing a political shell game. As Jay Michelson puts it, Republicans appear populist, but act plutocrat. What's disorienting is that this shell game has worked. Although Republicans have historically governed for the benefit of the rich, they've recently rebranded themselves, successfully, it seems, as the party of the working class. Is this new Republican messaging sincere, or is it gaslighting? Well, Trump's billionaire-stacked administration is quickly answering the question for us. However, this essay is not primarily about Trump, nor is it focused on the future. Instead, it's a journey into how the partisan politics of the past have shaped the American plutocracy of today. The essay consists of a deep dive into the realm of U.S. state politics. The story will be simple and repetitive. Across states, I'll measure the degree to which Republicans control each state's legislature. Then I'll observe, in a statistical sense, the policies and social outcomes that follow. That's it. Of course, I'll add commentary along the way, but the goal is to let the evidence speak for itself. And what leaps from the data is this. Republican control of state legislatures is systematically associated with the rich being and becoming richer. In short, American plutocracy seems to be a quintessentially Republican affair. And that's not all. As we journey into the depths of U.S. state politics, the plot will thicken. We'll find striking partisan differences in the language used in state bills. We'll see the many ways that Republicans help the rich and hurt workers. We'll see the impact partisan politics have on the population as they work longer hours with less security. We'll see the toll that Republican control takes on human welfare, and we'll study the ways that Republicans gain power, despite enacting policies that are self-evidently bad for the majority. And we'll reflect on the reasons that plutocracy can become self-reinforcing. Think of the evidence that follows as a case study in how the machinery of democracy can be used to benefit the few and harm the many. It's a warning from the past about tactics that will no doubt be intensified by Trump and his posse of plutocrats. A brief history of Republican red and Democratic blue. Diving into U.S. state politics, let's start with its geography. Today we take for granted that there's a steep divide between coastal, Democrat-voting blue states and interior, Republican-voting red states. But in historical terms, this geographic division is a fairly recent pattern. For example, if we rewind the clock to 1975, we find that state legislatures were overwhelmingly controlled by Democrats. Figure 1 shows the map of state partisan control at the time. Looking at this sea of blue, it's tempting to think that in 1975, the U.S. was a much more liberal place. And in some sense, it was. Still, we need nuance when interpreting the landscape of partisan control. The big picture of American politics is that over long time spans, partisan ideologies can change. Case in point, the Republican Party was once the party of progress. It was founded in 1854 to oppose the slave power of the southern states. then under the control of the Democratic Party. After the North won the Civil War and instituted a brief period of Reconstruction, pro-segregation Democrats re-ensconced themselves in the South while the North remained solidly Republican. Fast forward to the Great Depression. By then, Republicans had come to believe in minimal government intervention, so it was Democrats who championed the New Deal and the social safety net that would follow. By the end of World War II, New Deal Democrats had swept to power in the North, while Southern Democrats remained in control of the South. The height of this uneasy Democratic coalition came in the mid-1970s, as shown in Figure 1. By the 1980s, however, backlash against the civil rights movement caused Southern whites to abandon the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, Reagan's neoliberal revolution ushered Republicans into power in the North. All told, the map of state partisan control would be dramatically redrawn during the next 40 years. By 2017, Republicans controlled the majority of state legislatures. Figure 2 shows this sea of red. The party of plutocracy? With the neoliberal era red wave in mind, let's get to the meat of my thesis. Once the party of Lincoln, the evidence suggests that Republicans have since become the party of American plutocracy. As we'll see, Republican rule is systematically associated with the rich being and becoming richer. A coordinated U-turn, Republican fortunes and American income inequality. During the turmoil of the early 20th century, the banner of American politics switched colors. The left went from Republican red to Democratic blue, and the right vice versa. By the end of World War II, this transition was fairly mature, paving the way for the modern order in U.S. politics. In the post-war era, Republican state-level fortunes came in two waves. Until the mid-1970s, Republicans gradually lost seats, but from the 1980s onward, state legislatures steadily turned red. In Figure 3, the top panel shows this partisan U-turn, measured in terms of the average Republican share of state legislature seats, weighted by population. Now to American plutocracy. As the bottom panel in Figure 3 illustrates, the fall and rise of Republican fortunes mirrors another important U-turn, the fall and rise of U.S. income inequality, measured here in terms of the top 1% share of income. Republican control and plutocracy within U.S. states. Continuing our dive into Republican-driven plutocracy, the evidence thickens when we look within U.S. states. Here we see a glaring connection between Republican control and the fortunes of the very rich. Figure 4 makes the case. But before I jump into the data, let me pause to describe the chart's presentation. The chart's format will be repeated many times throughout this essay. On the horizontal axis, I measure the Republican share of state legislature seats. In each state and in each year, I sum the Republican-controlled seats in both the state House and the state Senate. Then I divide by the total number of state legislature seats. The goal here is to measure the degree of control that Republicans exert over each state's legislature. The data covers all U.S. states for the years indicated. In Figure 4, that's from 1970 to 2018. The caveat is that I'll assign Nebraska a null value. While Nebraska is in practice under staunch Republican control, its state legislature is officially nonpartisan. Hence, the notion of Republican seats is ill-defined. Next, note that Figure 4 does not plot raw data. Instead, it organizes states into groups based on the Republican share of state legislature seats. Within each group, I then measure the statistic of interest and plot it on the vertical axis. In Figure 4, this statistic is the income share of the state top 0.01%. Finally, note that the blue line shows the median of this statistic within each partisan bin, and the blue shaded region shows the middle 50% of data. Now to the evidence plotted in Figure 4. it decisively implicates the Republican Party in the construction and maintenance of American plutocracy. Across U.S. states, greater Republican control of state legislatures is associated with a steady rise in the income share of the top 0.01%. To summarize the evidence, Republican politics seem intrinsically connected with modern plutocratic outcomes. That said, there's more testimony to be teased out of this state-level data. For those who are interested, I've crunched additional statistics in the appendix. But for now, I'm going to forge ahead and see what other nefarious things come with Republican rule. Republican priorities: measuring the language in state bills. As the old truism goes, if you want to understand politics, watch what politicians do, not what they say. The caveat is that gone are the days when kings ruled by leading the charge into battle. Today's politicians govern by crafting legislation, which is then interpreted by civil servants and the courts. Given the written nature of modern governance, a good way to understand what politicians do is to study the text of their bills. In what follows, I analyze the text of thousands of U.S. state bills to see what we can learn about partisan priorities. True, there are many dimensions to partisan legalese, but here I'll highlight the jargon that relates to plutocracy. The language of class struggle. Although the rich would never use these words, they're incessantly engaged in class struggle. That's because what they call wealth is not a feature of the natural world. It's neither mined, nor minted, nor manufactured. Instead, wealth is a set of social relations that are imposed through the mechanism of property rights. And because property rights don't make themselves, the rules of wealth must be constantly articulated, tweaked, and enforced. On this front, the imposition of property rights is a quintessential form of class struggle, but it's one conducted by the ruling class using verbiage that is typically opaque and often arcane. We'll observe this jargon in a moment, but first, let's begin with the more familiar language of class struggle, the words used to describe the suffering at the bottom of society. In Figure 5, I've selected a sample of such words, terms like hardship, injustice, and oppression. Notice that for the ruling class, these words are toxic. There's no way to use them in a way that looks good for the rich, and so the solution is to avoid them. Or rather, the Republican solution is to avoid these words. Looking at the language in state bills, the jargon of class struggle becomes consistently less frequent as Republicans increase their grip on state legislative power. The language of ownership. Once purveyed by God, today the rules of power are secular. They're codified not in a divine text, but in the legal jargon of property. In capitalism, it's owners who rule, and it's owners who are rich. Of course, all governments are concerned with regulating ownership, but across U.S. states, this concern seems to have a partisan asymmetry. Far more than Democrats, it's Republican-dominated governments that use the jargon of ownership in their bills. Figure 6 shows the pattern. Looking at the words in Figure 6, what's fascinating is how this terminology contrasts with the folksy wisdom that Republicans use in their speeches. In public, we hear about freedom, about the market, about family values. But in private, what defines Republican legislation is talk about the obscurities of property rights. Arcane terms like heirship, lien holders, and investiture. For that matter, what even is investiture? Well, as Jonathan Knitson and Shimshon Bickler note, it's a feudal term that describes the symbolic ceremony of transferring property rights from the feudal lord to the vassal. The term would later get shortened to invest and gain a tone of productiveness, but in its original setting, the truth was clear. Investiture implied a transfer of power. At any rate, I'd guess that many American voters would be surprised by the obscure language of ownership that rises with Republican rule. It's not part of the GOP's public brand. The language of law and order. Continuing the theme of arcane terminology, let's turn now to the language of law and order, shown in Figure 7. Think of this language as the procedural counterpart to the jargon of ownership. To have a regime of property rights, governments first define a set of ownership rules. Then they endow the court system with a set of procedures for how these rules will be enforced. To be sure, all governments play this procedural game, but across U.S. states, they apparently do not play it equally. Instead, the language of law and order appears to be a Republican obsession. As Republicans seize state power, we see a 50-fold increase in obscure judicial jargon within state bills. An information mismatch. In my view, the partisan trends in legislative language highlight a key weakness of democracy. For voters, the information that's most easily available is what politicians say about themselves in public. But this politicking is low-quality data, frequently riddled with spin, half-truths, and outright lies. To make more informed decisions, voters need to know what politicians actually do, the substance of their bills and legislation. But this high-quality information is the most difficult to get. Sure, government bills are now available on the internet, but few people have the time or the expertise to wade through legislative legalese. In the past, the job fell to municipal reporters whose beat was to keep the public informed about the actions of their state and local government. But in the last few decades, this civic beat has largely vanished, leaving voters with whatever hearsay they receive on Facebook. More on Facebook use later. Regardless of the misinformation that voters get from punditry, the evidence generated by politicians' legislative behavior is quite clear. At the state level, Republican politicians do exactly what we would expect if they were governing for the benefit of plutocrats. They ignore the language of bottom-up class struggle, they emphasize the language of ownership, and they obsess over the procedural language of law and order. Creating plutocracy, Republican policy in action. Continuing the theme of what politicians do, let's look at the effects of Republican rule. To create plutocracy, Republicans have five main tactics. 1. Suppress the minimum wage. 2. Kill unions. 3. Tax the poor more than the rich. 4. Enrich owners. And 5. Cut government spending. In what follows, we'll look at the evidence for each tactic. Suppressing the minimum wage. Although Americans don't agree on much, they do agree that the federal minimum wage is abysmal. The backstory here is that the power to regulate wages resides largely with state governments. But as part of the New Deal, the U.S. federal government enacted a national minimum wage in 1938. The result is that today, U.S. labor law is a hodgepodge of legislation that's difficult to untangle. Some states have a higher minimum wage that supersedes the federal standard. Other states have a lower minimum wage that applies only to certain classes of workers. And a few states have no minimum wage at all. But again, the federal minimum wage applies to many workers in these states. My point is that when studying the minimum wage, the effects of state and federal law are complicated. However, the various state minimum wages are themselves quite clear in the sense that they reveal political priorities. In what follows, I'm going to compare each state's minimum wage to the average U.S. income. The idea is that what matters about a minimum wage is its relative value. For example, if a minimum wage worker is employed full-time, should they earn half the value of the average American income? Or should they earn far less, say a tenth the average income? These are moral questions which politicians answer when they set the minimum wage. Turning to state politics, the relative value of the minimum wage has a clear partisan dimension. As Figure 8 illustrates, the state minimum wage tends to decline as Republicans increase state legislative control. Killing unions. In 1847, the French socialist Louis Blanc coined the phrase the right to work, by which he meant that citizens had a right to gainful employment. Today, this idea is called a job guarantee, and it enjoys growing popularity. However, the phrase the right to work has long since been co-opted by reactionaries to refer to union-busting legislation. Unions. They are perhaps the key vehicle for counterbalancing the power of owners. As a cog in the corporate machine, an individual worker is powerless, but as a collective, workers can wield tremendous control. And that's why union-busting tactics are a crucial part of the plutocratic playbook. When you smash unions, you deprive workers of, among other things, the ability to bargain for a decent wage. Unions. Reactionary politicians can barely hide their disdain for them, and it shows in the data. When we measure the union membership rate across U.S. states, we find that it consistently declines with greater Republican legislative power. Figure 9 runs the numbers. Taxing the poor more than the rich. After George Bush's re-election in 2004, the linguist George Lakoff argued that Democrats had a messaging problem. Whereas Republicans couched their policy in folksy wisdom, Democrats continued to use outdated rhetoric. The solution, Lakoff proposed, was to rethink the message. For example, when Republicans offered tax cuts, Democrats should justify higher taxes by calling them a membership fee. Lakoff's idea has not aged well, largely because the left's problems run far deeper than messaging. Still, it's worth noting that Democratic policies are often more in line with public opinion, even if many voters don't know it. Taxes are a case in point. For example, a 2018 Gallup poll found that roughly two-thirds of Americans thought that the rich were taxed too little. And here, it's clear that not taxing the rich is a partisan game, played best by Republicans. Across U.S. states, greater Republican control of state legislatures is associated with a steady decline in the top marginal tax rate. Figure 10 shows the trend. Continuing our journey into U.S. taxation, states with a nil top tax rate generally have a nil rate across the board. That is, they have no state income tax. Now, on its face, this policy seems equitable, since everyone pays zero tax. But actually, the policy is radically unfair. That's because states without an income tax still have taxation, and the taxes that remain tend to be regressive. Sales tax is a good example. On the surface, a sales tax is a simple flat fee on consumer spending, but under the hood lies inequity. That's because, for their part, the poor have no choice but to spend much of their income on daily commodities, items which are covered by sales tax. But the rich, in contrast, spend much of their money on investments, expenditures that are not covered by sales tax. As a consequence of this spending asymmetry, sales taxes tend to be highly regressive. They tax the poor more than the rich. Hence, states that rely heavily on sales tax for government income tend to have a more regressive tax regime. And that brings me back to partisan politics. Looking at the total structure of state taxation, it turns out that Republican control is associated with a more regressive tax burden. Figure 11 does the math. Here, the vertical axis plots a measure of tax regressiveness, the degree to which the tax burden decreases with higher income. A lower value indicates more regressive taxation. Enriching owners. In his 1840 treatise, What is Property?, the anarchist philosopher Pierre-Joseph Proudhon answered succinctly, "Property is theft." I mention Proudhon's slogan because it reminds us of the full spectrum of political ideology. For the revolutionaries of the 19th century, almost everything was on the political table, including abolishing private property. Now, the caveat is that by property, Proudhon mostly meant the property rights, which entitle owners to income. income that Proudhon deemed theft. At any rate, while Proudhon's revolutionary rhetoric sits far outside the spectrum of mainstream American politics, it seems that the returns to property ownership remain on the political table. For example, when we look across U.S. states, we find that the portion of income going to property owners has a partisan dimension. It tends to rise with Republican control of state legislatures. Figure 12 shows the pattern. Looking at the partisan returns to ownership, I find the Z-shaped pattern quite interesting. Across much of the variation in state politics, the returns to property vary only slightly. Yet, when we get to the extremes of partisan control, either on the left or on the right, we see stark changes to the property share of income. Why? One possibility is that the mid-ground stability is caused by an elite consensus, a bipartisan agreement about the normal rate of return. This is Knitson and Bickler's term for the average rate of return that owners expect to earn on their property. The rate is set, Knitson and Bickler argue, by the social nomos, the set of beliefs and institutions that denominate the social order. Of course, it makes sense that this nomos should involve partisan politics, but what's surprising, in my mind, is how far into the partisan extremes we must go to see major changes to property income. Cutting government spending. In his 1981 inaugural address, Ronald Reagan summarized the Republican zeitgeist when he proclaimed, "Government is not the solution to our problem, government is the problem." Since then, it's become a cliche to hear Republicans respond to each new crisis by demanding government cutbacks. The odd thing about this cliche, though, is that at the level of the federal government, the cutback rhetoric is hollow. Since Reagan, Republicans have rarely shrunk federal spending. Instead, they reorder government priorities by seizing money from social programs and sending it to the Pentagon. However, when we turn to state governments, Reagan's cliche holds true. Across U.S. states, Republican control of state legislatures is associated with a noticeable decline in government spending as a share of state GDP. Figure 13 runs the numbers. So why do Republicans prefer small government? Well, their typical response is that compared to the private sector, government is inefficient. Fine, I'll grant that in some settings, government bureaucracy can be bloated. But as David Graeber argues in Bullshit Jobs, corporate bureaucracies suffer the same problem. As such, the rhetoric of efficiency seems to be largely a political distraction. A far more important difference between the public sector and the private sector is right there in the name. The public sector is public. It has no owners. But if you privatize a government program, you create property rights to own, and you send revenue to the new owners. In the same vein, the private sector tends to have a more plutocratic pay structure than the public sector. For example, consider the yawning gap between the income of U.S. state governors and their private sector peers, the CEOs of large U.S. corporations. Although both positions consist of helming large hierarchies, state governors were, in 2020, paid about 40 times less than their private sector counterparts. Figure 14 plots the chasm. This striking public-private pay difference reminds me of talk about discipline. For their part, when Republicans privatize government programs, they speak about the discipline of market competition. But the flip side is that privatizing public services frees money from the pay-limiting scrutiny of public office, or what we might call the discipline of democracy. One can see, then, why budding plutocrats would be in favor of shrinking government. It creates more revenue for owners, and it unshackles money from the discipline of democracy. Trickling down or pouring up? Relative income across U.S. states. With Republican legislative tactics out of the way, let's now deal with a concept that refuses to die. In the pantheon of bad ideas, trickle-down economics ranks with Russian roulette in terms of its self-evident stupidity. Sure, boss, I'll give you my money if you say it will trickle back down. In what follows, I search for evidence that Republicans' plutocratic policies lead to a trickle-down boost to income. Spoilers, I find the opposite. The post-war boom. Prosperity at the center. By most accounts, the peak of America's global dominance came in the late 1960s, at the height of the post-war boom. It was a period of unprecedented industrial growth, but also, by today's standards, a period of uncanny bipartisanship. Turning to American income, this bipartisanship left a distinctive mark. During the 1960s and early 1970s, American prosperity lived at the political center. Figure 15 shows the evidence. At the time, states with bipartisan legislative control tended to have the highest per capita income, while states with more partisan control, left or right, tended to be poorer. The peak of neoliberalism, prosperity on the left. Starting in the 1980s, Republicans swept into state power, bringing with them a host of pro-business policies. As it turns out, the effects of these policies are written on America's modern income landscape. But when it comes to trickle-down economics, the trouble is that these income effects go in the wrong direction. Figure 16 illustrates. Today, average state income remains strongly tied to the partisan control of state legislatures. However, it's now Democrat-controlled states which tend to be richer, while Republican-controlled states tend to be poorer. In short, if the wealth is trickling down, the evidence has a funny way of showing it. The plutocracy is the point. To summarize, it's difficult to find evidence that Republican rule has led to wealth trickling down. But then again, that's because trickle-down theory was never serious science. It was always a rhetorical mask for a more straightforward goal, making the rich richer. On that front, when we take the stated goal of enriching the wealthy at face value, suddenly the evidence makes sense. Across states, the relative income of the richest Americans scales consistently with Republican politics. Figure 17 illustrates. So it seems that despite the trickle-down charade, the plutocracy was always the point. The American Hustle. So far, we've seen that Republican legislative control is associated with greater income inequality, as well as a host of pro-business, anti-worker outcomes. Continuing this theme, let's turn now to some social ills that lie downstream of Republican rule. Working longer hours. In the incendiary words of Karl Marx, the struggle for normal working hours consists of, quote, a protracted civil war between the capitalist class and the working class. Today, the battle is not over. True, bosses have largely abandoned their most ghoulish 19th century tactics, such as forcing employees to work 70-hour weeks. Instead, what today's bosses demand is flexibility. And that, it seems, is code for low pay. You see, a poorly paid workforce is a pliable workforce. If folks are struggling to make ends meet, they don't need to be told to work longer hours. They'll do it of their own accord. On that front, we've already seen that across US states, Republican legislative control is associated with a host of pro-business policies which, among other things, worsen the minimum wage and kill unions. So how do workers respond to this newfound flexibility? Well, it seems that they react by working longer hours. Figure 18 shows the pattern. Across US states, Republican governance is associated with a consistent rise in the length of the average workweek. More bankruptcies. When it comes to social safety nets, things like unemployment insurance get much of the attention, but I'd argue that bankruptcy law is also essential. Without the right to file bankruptcy, folks with unpayable debts risk becoming indentured servants to their creditors. Of course, as with claiming unemployment insurance, filing for bankruptcy is not a good thing. It's a sign that someone's finances have gone catastrophically wrong. And unfortunately, in the United States, there's a baked-in reason for financial catastrophe. It's called healthcare. Alone among wealthy countries, the U.S. still ties health insurance to employment, which means that many of the most vulnerable Americans are uninsured. When these people get sick, they frequently go bust. As a result, about two-thirds of U.S. personal bankruptcies are caused by medical debt. Surveying this scene of financial destruction, we find that it's not distributed evenly. Instead, rates of personal bankruptcy have a partisan dimension. They tend to increase with Republican state control. Figure 19 runs the numbers. More food insecurity. In her book, How the Other Half Dies, Susan George argues that famines are political beasts. They're not caused by global food shortages, but by a failure to distribute the world's food surplus to those who need it. Turning to the United States, the situation is similar. Although the nation has ample food, about 1 in 10 Americans is food insecure, meaning they struggle to afford good food. As with famines, this food insecurity is a political problem. In fact, it's a partisan problem. Across U.S. states, rates of food insecurity tend to rise with Republican legislative control. Figure 20 shows the pattern. Going negative, partisan politics and human welfare. Continuing the theme of social strife, let's dive into the politics of human welfare. In what follows, we'll see if American health has a partisan dimension. Spoiler, it does. More people without health insurance. Home to some of the world's best medical facilities, the U.S. also boasts one of the lowest life expectancies among wealthy nations. This dichotomy is no paradox. It's a predictable feature of American plutocracy. For the rich, American healthcare is best in class, but for the poor, it's a disaster. The catastrophe starts with the political failure to provide health insurance to all. Actually, this failure is a partisan problem. Across U.S. states, the portion of people without health insurance tends to rise with Republican control of state legislatures. Figure 21 does the math. More deaths of despair. Continuing our investigation of American welfare, let's turn now to what Anne Case and Angus Deaton call deaths of despair. These are self-induced deaths due to suicide, drug overdose, and alcoholism. In their 2020 book, Case and Deaton show that in the U.S., deaths of despair have risen starkly over the last few decades. The question is why? Case and Deaton argue convincingly that these deaths are largely a civic pathology caused by the social determinants of health. Among Americans with a college degree, there's been no dramatic change in drug, alcohol, and suicide mortality. But among folks without a college degree, these deaths have exploded. Case and Deaton conclude, quote, "Deaths of despair are prevalent among those who've been left behind, whose lives have not worked out as they expected." To this summary, I would add that deaths of despair have a partisan dimension. They're higher within Republican-controlled states. Figure 22 shows the evidence. Lower life expectancy. In 2015, driven largely by rising drug overdoses, U.S. life expectancy started dipping for the first time since World War II. This subtle decline was the calm before the storm. When COVID hit, the dip became a life expectancy dive. Much has been said about the United States' unique pandemic failings, to which I have little to add. But I will note that in modern America, even death has become politicized. Across U.S. states, life expectancy now has a distinct partisan dimension. It tends to decline with the degree of Republican control. Figure 23 plots the pattern. Unhealthy and aware of it. When we turn to Americans' self-reported health, the plot continues to thicken. Not only does life expectancy have a partisan dimension, so does Americans' assessment of their own health. Looking at figure 24, it seems that as Republicans gain legislative seats, a larger portion of the state population reports having poor or fair health. Likewise, a similar pattern holds for mental health, as shown in figure 25. Across states, Republican control is associated with more self-reported days of poor mental health. Meta-awareness? To summarize our foray into American welfare, residents of Republican-controlled states tend to die younger than their peers in Democratic strongholds, suffer more from self-induced deaths of despair, and appear to be aware of their own bad health. What remains unknown, however, is whether there's meta-awareness of these patterns. In other words, are Americans aware that there exists a partisan health hierarchy? And are they aware of their status in this hierarchy? To date, we don't have the data to answer these questions, but I suspect that on both fronts, the answer is largely no. The wrong sort of beacon. For all his failings, Donald Trump has achieved one thing. He's taken American politics to a darker place. Now, it's not that dark politics are good in their own right. It's that for years, Americans' mainstream political rhetoric has been growing out of touch with reality. Ever since Reagan, American elites have regurgitated his sunny vision of U.S. exceptionalism, endlessly professing America as a beacon of hope for the rest of the world. And yet, increasingly, the U.S. is the wrong sort of beacon. For a host of indicators, it's worst in class among rich nations. So at least with Trump, we have a politician who proclaims, right in his Make America Great Again slogan, that America is no longer great. On this ominous note, it seems fitting to close our journey into the U.S. partisan landscape by studying what has become the signature element of American exceptionalism. Its project of mass incarceration. More mass incarceration. Because there are so few parallels, it's difficult to communicate the scale of American incarceration. But here's one comparison. In per capita terms, U.S. imprisonment sits only slightly below Rwanda, a country that not long ago endured a mass genocide. Yes, modern America is an exceptional place. The U.S. project of mass incarceration began as a response to the crime wave of the 1970s and early 1980s, and yet from the outset, the project had a political tone. As Bickler and Knitson observe, the growth of American mass incarceration went hand in hand with rising income inequality, a pattern that they argue is no coincidence. Even today, American incarceration bears the long shadow of plutocratic partisan politics. Across U.S. states, rates of imprisonment tend to rise with Republican governance. Figure 26 shows the trend. More crime. For its part, prison time is often touted as both punishment for convicted criminals and a deterrent for would-be crooks. But regarding the latter claim, there's little evidence that imprisonment actually lowers crime. For example, across U.S. states, crime rates tend to rise with incarceration rates, a sign that imprisonment is largely a response to crime, but an ineffective deterrent. Instead, the seeds for crime are laid by social pathologies like unemployment, poverty, and drug abuse. Incarceration simply punishes further, the folks who suffer from these diseases, and as with the punishment, the pathology of crime has a partisan dimension. Across U.S. states, rates of property crime tend to increase with Republican legislative control, figure 27, as do rates of murder, figure 28. Cause, effect, or both. This concludes my journey into the partisan dimensions of America's social pathologies. What leaps from the evidence is the fact that Republican governance is associated with a host of bad outcomes. What's less clear is whether Republican politics cause these pathologies or whether social strife leads to Republican politics. I think both forms of causation are plausible. On the first count, Republican policies amplify income inequality, thereby harming the working class and benefiting the rich. From this heightened class struggle, bad things almost certainly follow. On the second count, it seems that Republicans have learned how to weaponize American anger for their own benefit. They offer simple but wrong solutions to difficult problems, so it makes sense that states with the deepest social strife would also be the deepest red. Alarmingly, if this two-way causation exists, it points to a kind of vicious feedback cycle. Republican-driven plutocracy causes social strife, which then leads to public anger and more disillusioned votes for Republican control. If this feedback cycle is real, I propose we call it the express elevator to plutocratic hell. How do Republicans win? Let's switch gears. So far, we've looked at data which connects Republican state governance to both plutocracy and widespread social pathology. Staring at this evidence, it seems like an oxymoron. It's the sort of bad outcome that, you'd think, shouldn't exist in a democracy, since most people should vote against it. So then how do Republicans win elections? This question, incidentally, was fielded in 2003 by then-Congressman Bernie Sanders. Speaking to a class of high school students, Sanders lays out the quintessential Republican strategy, which is to divide and conquer. To win elections, he observes, Republicans pander to divisive cultural issues, but when in power, they govern for the benefit of plutocrats. In broad terms, I think Bernie is correct. That said, there are some subtleties to Republicans' bait and switch tactic, which need to be teased out. The first subtlety is that the Republican Party benefits greatly from the structure of the U.S. electoral system, which amplifies small variation in partisan support, and which tends to underrepresent the interest of urban voters. The second subtlety is that Republican politicians are part of a broader propaganda machine that bombards voters with reactionary messaging. Crucial to this messaging, I believe, is that Americans' media habits now have a striking partisan asymmetry. In what follows, we'll look at each of these problems in more detail. A deficit of democracy. In 1975, the Trilateral Commission published an infamous report called The Crisis of Democracy. In it, the authors warned that the United States suffered from an excess of democracy, an excess which they claimed was causing a deficit in governability. Reading between the lines, what the deeply reactionary authors meant was that organized labor power was making it difficult for the U.S. ruling class to govern by and for itself. Today, as the billionaire-packed Trump regime demonstrates, this deficit has been reversed. The U.S. now suffers from a deficit of democracy and an excess of governability, read plutocratic authority. But while the problem is modern, the seeds for this democratic deficit date back centuries to the creation of the U.S. electoral system. On the electoral front, many Americans are proud that their country is the oldest surviving democratic republic. Yet sometimes age can be a burden. In the years since the U.S. Constitution was written, political scientists have learned much about the benefits and failings of different electoral systems. For example, U.S. framers borrowed the British system of first-past-the-post voting, in which whomever wins the most votes in a district wins the seat. This system has the advantage of being simple, but has the disadvantage of leading to many perverse outcomes. The most well-known perversity is the fact that first-past-the-post voting amplifies small changes in partisan support. The result is that huge electoral majorities can be built on a small plurality, or sometimes even a minority, of votes. Turning to U.S. state governments, pundits often look at electoral maps and comment on the shocking difference between red states and blue states. And in terms of partisan control, these states do look like different countries. The mistake, though, is to assume that electoral differences indicate enormous variation in voters' preferences. But actually, the opposite is true. Across U.S. states, drastic variation in partisan control is built on fairly minor changes in public opinion. Figure 29 illustrates. To explain the chart, let's look first at the horizontal axis, which plots the portion of state legislature seats controlled by Republicans in 2019. What's important is that across state legislatures, Republican control varies over a roughly 80-point range. Next, let's look at the vertical axis, which plots public opinion within states, the portion of people with a favorable view of Republicans. Naively, we might expect that this public opinion should follow the dashed red line, which indicates parity between polling data and electoral outcomes. For example, in states where Republicans win 20% of the legislature seats, we might expect that 20% of the population would have a favorable view of the party. Likewise, in states where Republicans win 80% of the seats, 80% of people should have a favorable view of the party. When we look at actual polling data, however, this naive expectation turns out to be way off the mark. Looking at real-world opinion gives the blue curve in Figure 29, which is a testament to the failings of first-past-the-post voting. Across the 80-point swing in Republican legislative control, voter opinion about Republicans varies over a much smaller range, around 15 percentage points. The message here is that to win landslide elections, Republicans must achieve only modest changes in public opinion. A partisan asymmetry. Now to a second defect of first-past-the-post voting, which is that it amplifies partisan support unequally. In his book, Why Cities Lose, Jonathan Rodden dives deeply into this asymmetry, arguing, persuasively, that America's democratic deficit is caused in large part by the geography of modern partisanship. Put simply, Democrats have become an urban party, while Republicans have become an exurban and rural party. Now, on its face, it seems like the geography of partisan support shouldn't matter, since government representation should always track with population. But Rodden demonstrates why this assumption fails. The problem lies with the interplay between partisan geography and first-past-the-post voting. With support concentrated in city centers, Democrats tend to win big in urban districts. That is, they get a huge share of the district vote. But this victory turns out to be a loss in disguise. You see, in first-past-the-post voting, once a party has achieved a seat-winning plurality, all additional votes are wasted. They do nothing to affect the election results. So the goal in this system is not to win big in a few districts, it's to win by a small margin in many districts. As Rodden shows, the dispersed geography of Republican support means that the party is better at playing this small victory game. And when gerrymandering enters the picture, the partisan asymmetry becomes even more pronounced. Returning to U.S. public opinion, the electoral bias against Democrats turns out to be quite visible in the polling data. Figure 30 makes the case. Here I've taken the polling data from Figure 29 and added Democrat favorability to the mix. To reiterate, the red curve shows how Republican favorability relates to Republican control of state legislatures. And now the blue curve shows how Democrat favorability relates to Democrat control of state legislatures. What's striking is the gap between the two curves. At virtually every level of state electoral success, Democrats poll better than Republicans. In other words, to achieve the same level of government power, it seems that Democrats must win more votes. The politics of indoctrination. With the U.S. democratic deficit in mind, let's pivot now to the partisan nature of political indoctrination. Here, I think we should start with George Orwell, who has in many ways informed our ideas about propaganda and groupthink. The problem with Orwell is that he's too, well, Orwellian. In 1984, Orwell depicts indoctrination that's so fiendish, so totalizing that it seems cartoonish. Of course, that was the point. 1984 was meant as a satire. However, the lasting effect of Orwell's writing has been to raise the bar for what constitutes indoctrination. Big Brother makes true propaganda, but in our society, we don't have anything like that. Of course, we do have propaganda, but it's typically more subtle than the Orwellian ideal. It's designed to nudge public opinion, not transform it. Actually existing propaganda is in many ways banal. The meat of it is what we might call biased information, journalism that elevates some narratives over others. In that regard, propaganda has always been ubiquitous. Just look at the load of junk on the internet. But what's changed in recent years is the way people consume information. In modern America, media consumption now has a distinct partisan asymmetry. To see this asymmetry, let's start by simply counting people's sources for political news. Figure 31 shows the results. Across U.S. states, it seems that greater Republican control is associated with less diversity in people's news consumption. Thinking about this partisan-related decline in media diversity, it's instructive to look at the news sources that remain when we head into deep Republican territory. As you might guess, red state stalwarts are not rushing to read the New York Times. Instead, they lean towards what we might call a Fox book diet, which consists of a helping of news from just two sources, Fox and Facebook. Figure 32 plots the rise of this diet. In my mind, this partisan diet is instructive, if a bit unsurprising. For its part, Fox News has a Republican bias that's about as subtle as a punch to the face. So if Republican voters aren't watching Fox, it would be shocking. Facebook, in contrast, is an algorithmic beast that cares only about keeping users on its platform. So in that regard, the site is non-partisan. However, Facebook's algorithm seems to have learned that the best way to maximize engagement is to feed users a steady stream of rage-inducing clickbait. And as we now know, one does not generate engagement-maximizing content with journalism that carefully surveys the evidence. That job is done best with made-up facts and strident lies. Am I saying that Republican control rests on lies? Yes, I am. Finally, let's not discount the opinion-shaping importance of ignorance. In modern America, a non-negligible portion of the population does not follow political news. In effect, these folks are the most gullible marks because when fed political propaganda, whether from friends, colleagues, or political advertising, they have no independent sources on which to judge their claims. As such, these poorly informed folks tend to ride whatever zeitgeist they're served. Now, in any setting, being poorly informed about politics is an anathema to healthy democracy, but in the Citizens United era, the stakes are even higher. Today, Americans are subjected to a torrent of oligarch-backed political advertising that's so pervasive it's nearly impossible to escape. And so, without a steady inoculation of journalistic facts, this plutocratic propaganda will inevitably do its job. Indeed, the effect may already be visible. Across states, political ignorance now has a partisan dimension. As Figure 33 shows, Republican state power is associated with more people who don't follow political news. Am I saying that Republican control rests on voter ignorance? Yes, I am. A nudge is all you need. Looking at the partisan dimension of American media consumption, I should note that the effects are somewhat subtle. For example, when we travel from deep blue states to deep red states, the Fox Book media diet increases by about 10 percentage points. Likewise, the diet of political ignorance, no political media consumption, increases by about 3.5 percentage points. Summing these two diets, we get a roughly 14-point swing in media consumption across the state partisan spectrum. Obviously, this 14-point swing is not Orwellian. In other words, there is no state population that receives all of its political information from Big Brother Murdoch or Little Brother Zuckerberg. But then again, in the US electoral system, there's no need for such totalizing propaganda. As we saw in Figure 29, the difference between a Republican state landslide and a Republican state shutout rests on a roughly 15-point swing in voter opinion. In short, American propaganda doesn't need to move mountains. It just needs to convince about 1 in 7 people to alter their opinions. In this context, a 14-point change in voters' media habits is massive. It's conceivably the whole partisan effect. This is the deceptive power of the conservative media empire and the unwitting power of the American swing voter. The tyranny of riches. To conclude this journey into the partisan politics of American plutocracy, perhaps some reflection is in order. As a scientist, I often find it gut-wrenching to watch the snail's pace at which established scientific knowledge trickles into the public consciousness. The study of income inequality is a good example. In 2001, Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez published a landmark paper which showed, for the first time, that U.S. top income shares had been on the rise since the 1980s. Piketty and Saez's work has since been replicated and expanded numerous times. In short, scientists know that the US is becoming increasingly plutocratic, but the public has been slow to catch on. And in a sense, that's not their fault. The average person has neither the time nor the training to read scientific papers. So if they receive news about inequality, plutocracy, or oligarchy, it'll be from secondhand sources. But even then, such topics rarely enter the mainstream news until elites start to discuss them. On that front, Joe Biden made waves in his farewell address by warning that an oligarchy is taking shape in America, marked by a dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a very few ultra-wealthy people. Now, what's remarkable about Biden's language is its rarity in American history. A quick search of presidential speeches suggests that prior to Biden, sitting presidents have used the word oligarchy just 3 times. Moreover, the last president to speak the word oligarchy was Franklin D. Roosevelt, who used it in 1937. What's also notable are the circumstances behind Biden's remark. It took an incoming president who was, in plain sight, packing his administration with billionaires for an exiting president to warn of the dangers of oligarchy. Shakespeare couldn't have written a more tragic affair. Indeed, the word tragedy seems appropriate. For its part, the left often assumes that politics is like theater and citizens are the audience. So when the plot goes awry, everyone knows. But a more fitting metaphor is that politics is theater and citizens are characters. They're unwitting participants who have unequal knowledge of the plotline that surrounds them. It's this inequality, I believe, that is the undoing of democracy. Those who were paying attention knew that Trump stood boldly for oligarchy and that his working class rhetoric was snake oil. Clearly, American billionaires could read between the lines, probably because Trump's bombast was new, but his bait-and-switch tactic was old Republican hat. And yet, a majority of Americans bought the lies that Trump was selling. Why? Historians will, no doubt, be unpacking this question for decades, but for what it's worth, I think we can tentatively answer the question right now. Working-class Americans are angry, yes, but they're also uninformed, and in a way that plays directly into the hands of plutocrats. For their part, the rich rarely get hoodwinked by political propaganda. For example, we never hear about the billionaire who mistakenly voted for a progressive politician thinking they, the politician, would deliver tax breaks. And yet it's a tired trope to hear about working class folks voting for a candidate who speaks their language but who's actually on the side of oligarchs. This knowledge asymmetry is a key weakness of democracy, a weakness that's being exploited before our eyes. Indeed, we don't need to wait for the plot climax to see how it works. Today's polling data lays it bare. In modern America, the diversity of people's news consumption increases starkly with their income. Figure 34 shows the ascent. In my mind, this evidence illustrates how the trappings of democracy can be used to ensconce plutocracy. As the rich get richer, they use their time and resources to become information-sucking machines. Meanwhile, as the poor get poorer, they fall into a pit of political ignorance where they become easy victims of propaganda. In a sense, this asymmetry is why reactionary politics are so easy and why progressive politics are so difficult. Reactionary politics push snake oil downhill. Progressive politics push knowledge and solidarity uphill. For American voters, it's become increasingly difficult to differentiate the two political forms, largely because many Republican politicians have adopted working-class rhetoric that was once the domain of leftists. And yet, when we study what Republican politicians do, the rhetoric falls apart. As we've seen here, repeatedly, and to the point of nausea, the evidence points overwhelmingly to one conclusion. In modern America, Republicans are the party of plutocracy. Well, that's it for this post. If you want to support more free thinking, data-driven research about big social issues, consider becoming a patron. You can sign up at economicsfromthetopdown.com/membership. And if you're interested in the data and methods behind all the charts in this post, you can find a link in the notes. Until next time, I'm Blair Fix.